Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew. And so do we. It's Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. A special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, we gathered outside Millstream Brewing Company in Amana, a beautiful evening, to talk politics with columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman, as well as political reporter James Lynch of the Gazette. We discussed President Trump's struggle to make good on campaign promises. Also, a look at the first few weeks under new Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Lots for our panelists and our audience to chew over. Pints and Politics just ahead. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Yesterday evening, we gathered before a live audience outside Millstream Brewing Company in Amana to talk politics with columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman, as well as political reporter James Lynch of the Gazette. My co-host was Gazette investigative reporter Aaron Jordan. It's a beautiful late June evening. The birds twittering out there, tweeting, we're going to talk about later.
Oh, yeah.
How appropriate.
So what do we want to get to first, Aaron?
Well, you know, last week we had a lot of hubbub in Cedar Rapids. We had a very important visitor in town. You know, when President Trump came to speak at the U.S. Cellular Center, there were something like 6,000 people there in the venue, another several hundred folks out on the street protesting. I think one person got arrested for throwing an egg. You know, it was a big night. I spent the night at the Gazette in the newsroom doing live fact-checking. So that was an interesting experience for me, you know, trying to kind of check these things that were coming out. It was a long speech. It was about 70 minutes. So I guess we wanted to start with our panel, and they, you know, all had various things they were doing that night. James, do you want to tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, it was an interesting evening. As Aaron said, there were about 6,000 people inside the U.S. Cellular Center. I've always said I don't know why people go to these events, because, you know, some of them got there at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, sit there for a 7 o'clock event. I mean, it's like all day. I don't have that sort of patience, I guess. But true believers, you know, show up early and stay till the end. The crowd was pretty enthusiastic, especially when anybody teed off on the media, which was very comforting and, you know, made me feel welcome. But it was interesting to see the reaction the president got, because we hear about his popularity slipping, that people aren't as enamored with him. These people are still very enamored with him. They pretty much hung on every word. They cheered at all the right times and booed at all the right times. It was his crowd. It was his people.
And, you know, I was going to point out that that our editorial page at the Gazette had written a front page editorial, a letter to the president that received a lot of national attention. And even though it was called Bush League by, you know, an Iowa politician, you know, Todd, maybe you want to address how the Gazette decided to do that.
Well, you know, as an editorial board, we decided that with the president coming to town, this was a unique opportunity to sort of list some concerns that we have with issues, proposals that he started to make in the early months of his campaign, and sort of looked at the fact that he's having a campaign rally and decided to sort of chide him, you know, fairly politely and say, you really shouldn't be campaigning. You've won. You should actually be listening to Iowans who may end up being affected by various cuts to programs, by policies that the administration is beginning to pursue. So we think at this point in a presidency, as he's forming his game plan, as he's, you know, making a budget plan and making proposals to Congress, that he actually should be doing more listening to Americans who would be affected instead of going and having campaign rallies like he had during much of the last 18 months before he was elected.
And what was reaction to that from Gazette readers?
It was, as I said in a Sunday column, it was mixed, as you might imagine. There were some people that really liked it, and there were some that thought we were being disrespectful to the president, that we should give him a chance instead of criticizing him. We got a lot of comments from outside of the circulation area, outside of even the United States. There were a couple from Ireland that it got around, I guess. But we didn't do it to get attention. We basically got it, or we did it to sort of use that front page real estate, which is prominent, to sort of make the points that we wanted to make.
Linda Waddington, what was your angle on the presidential visit, the first visit by Donald Trump since he's been president, to Iowa?
Well, I didn't go. Some of you are already aware that we had a death in the family, an unexpected death. And honestly, I just didn't feel up to putting up with the hype either inside or outside the building. And I think sometimes it's okay to kind of take a step back. So, I stayed home. I did actually end up opening Twitter. And I was kind of interested in seeing the national media coming into Iowa when it's not a caucus season, what they saw, what they were documenting. And, they were documenting a lot of the conflicts between the two different sides that were at the rally. And I think that's a national story. I'm just a little sad that Iowa kind of got in on that storyline. I wish that we could have... I understand people want to protest and that they want to have their voice heard, but I think there could have been much more constructive ways of doing that other than standing across the street in the rain, shaking a sign and yelling. So, I hope Iowans in the future get a little bit more creative. And then I think we'll see a big difference, and I think that we'll keep the caucuses here.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Pints and Politics, Iowa Public Radio, partnering once again with the Gazette. You've been listening to James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman of the Gazette, my able co-host here, Aaron Jordan, investigative reporter for the Gazette. I'm Ben Kiefer. Aaron, you mentioned healthcare. Let's get our views from our panelists about healthcare.
Yeah, so this week there was a delay. There was no vote in the Senate in terms of a healthcare proposal. And, we're going to have to wait till after the 4th of July for that. What do you guys think? James, do you have any thoughts about whether we're going to see a break toward the more middle of the road phase, or is it going to become more conservative?
Well, Mitch McConnell has said that if Republicans can't come to an agreement on this, they're going to have to start negotiating with Democrats. He said that like it was a bad thing, but, it seems like the way the process should be working is that they're negotiating. What's interesting is this is one of those issues where people on the left and the right don't like the bill. I mean, you've got Rand Paul, who is opposed to it, and then, of course, the liberals and progressives don't like it either. So, I keep hearing Mitch McConnell say he wants to get to 50 senators supporting this, which means that Mike Pence is going to have to cast the deciding vote. That's, the slimmest of margins. It doesn't seem like that's a good way to make a major policy change that affects, 1/6 of the economy without any Democratic support and not even all that much, all the Republicans on board.
How has Iowa's input in the Senate here fared? The last I checked, Senators Grassley and Ernst were still in the I'm still reading, still thinking, still considering. I don't know. You can call it an excuse, or you can say it is actually still considering. What's going on there? Do we hear them leaning one way or another, or are they just glad not to have to vote for this?
I think they're probably happy they don't have to vote before they come home for the 4th of July. But, they both seem ready to support a change in healthcare policy. Senator Grassley yesterday was saying, it's changing hour by hour. Don't ask me for my judgment on this bill until the day of the vote or an hour before the vote, which seems like maybe there should be a little more time for reflection and input than just a day or an hour. But Keeping it close to his vest.
The rollout of this wasn't good. I'm looking at the results of a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. Just 17% of Americans surveyed say they approve of the Senate's health care plan. 55% saying they disapprove. So what does that tell us about where this goes from here? Are we going to have senators and representatives voting for something that is in that much disapproval?
The challenge is that, especially in the House, if it gets back to the House, is all those folks are up for election next year. And they have to somehow figure out how they're going to justify a vote for this bill when they come back to Iowa or wherever, their district. And, there's not much support, as you said. I mean, the support is very, very weak. And it's going to be tough to make a case that, I did this in your best interest.
Well, and one of the strongest constituencies against this bill right now are Republican governors. Now, Kim Reynolds hasn't joined those ranks, but there are a lot of Republican governors looking at the reductions in Medicaid funding, looking at their state budgets, and they can't make that work. And they know they can't make it work. And so those Medicaid cuts, those are going to be real over the next decade. They're going to affect states. If they block grant this program, it's going to be a huge budgetary, disaster for a lot of states. And governors of all stripes, Republicans and Democrats are looking at that and saying, there's no way we can make that work. You can't pass this.
I guess one of the best headlines I saw, in my judgment, on this topic was a takeoff of a Monty Python line. It's not dead yet. So we'll see in the coming weeks.
I thought you were going to say every sperm is sacred.
No. Or it's only a flesh wound.
It's only a flesh wound. That's
so, Linda,
I'm
I see you.
Sparrow cover a coconut.
Linda, I think you had said Linda wanted us to avoid Russia, and she's tried to distract me from Russia, but I'm going to come back to it.
Erin, you're not supposed to point out that I didn't want to discuss Russia.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm new at this, so. We're going to bring that back and say, so do you guys think we're going to be seeing more of this? Do you think the visit between President Trump and Vladimir Putin is significant? What do you think is going to be going on?
I think it's going to be a friendly visit. I think they'll get along pretty well. We're at this point where now the special prosecutor's behind the scenes doing his thing. You do have the intelligence committee and various committees doing investigations. So there are going to be stories. I mean, the media is still digging. But, I think until we get a new batch of revelations or something sort of stunning, it's probably going to be that percolating pot on the back burner for a while.
How have you seen members of Congress reacting to this special counsel, Robert Mueller? Investigating it. Of course, the Democrats, predictable there, their reactions, but more interestingly, perhaps the Republicans in Congress?
Well, when he was appointed, I think there were a lot of Republicans that were pleased that someone of his stature and who's well-respected was appointed. I mean, we've seen since folks that are kind of Trump loyalists, Newt Gingrich and people like that, sort of try to criticize him and suggest remarkably that maybe Trump should fire him, which I think would be...
That he's part of the deep state.
Yeah, it would be an enormous mistake for Trump to do that. But I think there's a great deal of bipartisan confidence that Robert Mueller is the person who can handle this, and he's been hiring a lot of good people. And so with that said, I think whatever he comes up with is going to be real and accepted for the large part. Of course, there'll be a partisan battle and there'll be criticism, one way or the other. But I think, his reputation is such that whatever his investigation finds is going to have legs.
But I think they have to find something soon. If there aren't revelations soon, I think this has the danger of becoming sort of the Whitewater investigation that kind of goes on forever and you forget about it. And then it comes up in the news and then you forget about it. And then in the end, it's like, what was that about? I mean, so far, there is no there in this Russian investigation. And unless there are some revelations, it's just going to be hanging around like a bad cold.
Well, it may be that, what he finds isn't Russian related, but he's got broad latitude. And I mean, that's when you start digging, you don't. And that's you're right about Whitewater. you know, who knows?
And I think the danger in this 24-hour news cycle and the cable news stations and blogging and all of this is that it sucks all the other air out of the room. I mean, I still have hopes for an infrastructure bill. You know, why can't we fix our bridges? But yet we have all of these people and all of these experts on TV day after day after day talking about Russia and what might have happened in this tweet or that person said this or this source said that. Let's fix the bridges. I mean, let the special investigator go and do what he was hired to do, and let's get on with the job of running the country.
So, Linda, you're mentioning Twitter and that sort of thing. I'm getting to a question from one of our audience here. It says, how can we maintain a level of civility when the, quote, leader of the free world tweets derogatory remarks on a daily basis? There were some comments made about a broadcast reporter recently, and I guess, Linda, do you want to take that one? Or
sure. So if you didn't happen to see it or you didn't hear about it, Trump talks about Morning Joe, who's on MSNBC, and his co-host Mika. And they came to see him supposedly at Mar-a-Lago. And he says Mika was bleeding profusely from her face, obviously after having a facelift. Now, I don't understand what that has to do in our presidential discourse. And now that's going to be a part of the Library of Congress. But you notice we didn't, you know, hear anything about Morning Joe perhaps getting a brow lift or, you know, some lip work done. Well, it was the woman.
He was labeled Psycho Joe, though. Psycho Joe, and she was low IQ, crazy Mika. So, Speaker Paul Ryan... Of course, this puts Republicans in the Congress in a very uncomfortable position. Speaker Ryan having to say, he talked about the crude tweet from the president saying it was not an appropriate comment. We've heard this before. Are there any consequences for the president? And moreover, when we talk about civility and a level of discussion we expect from the president, is this the new norm?
You know, I have lots to say about the president grabbing by the house cat. But at the end of the day, it's not going to be me sitting up here saying this is wrong that's going to change what he says or that's going to make people once again sensitized to that type of language. Unfortunately, that's going to have to come from the men. Well, and not from the women.
And I don't think it's going to be normalized from the practical standpoint that his tweets and the things he says on social media, they torpedo his own agenda. They torpedo his own arguments. They torpedo his objectives. I mean, his foot is gone. It's been shot so many times. And I understand that he wants to win these petty fights with people, but in the end, he's only hurting himself and his agenda and whatever semblance of stature he has left as president. I'm pretty much convinced now that he's not going to pivot and to become presidential. I think we can all settle on that now. But well, it's you know, it's...
Perhaps this is the new presidential.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think so.
It's this president, but I don't know that it's going to be any other president. And I was going to say that, you know, despite everybody pretty much agreeing that he's torpedoing his own agenda, that this is not, you know, contributing to the civility of the discussion. You know, we saw at his rally that people still love him. And men and women at that rally were cheering him and cheering for his policies. So in a way, he's, you know, he hears the applause, he hears the chants, and he says, I'll keep doing this. I mean, I don't think it's going to stop until either his family or his cabinet, you know, intervene. And, I mean, you look at the people who surround the president, they're mostly smart, successful people. You know, Rex Tillerson didn't tweet when he was running an oil company. You know, the Goldman Sachs folks weren't tweeting like this when they were on Wall Street. So they know what the consequences are and that this really isn't working for the president. But apparently nobody can convince him that he should stop.
I spoke to some of my family recently, and my family are Trump supporters, and they also are big fans of It used to be WWF wrestling. I think it's WWE wrestling now. And one of my nephews told me that this is the Stone Cold Steve Austin president. And if you, I don't know if any of you are fans of entertainment wrestling, but there are echoes of what Trump says in that type of a venue. So definitely this appeals to his base. They see it as in your face. They see it as being bold and not giving in to political correctness and so forth. I mean, they see something very promising in these types of things.
If I could jump in, Aaron, there's a new Gallup poll, the annual confidence poll. Perhaps you saw this from Gallup, found that Americans trust in the mass media to report news fully, accurately, and fairly reached its lowest level in polling history. Only 32% saying they have a great deal or a fair amount of trust in the media. So we're part of the media.
Right.
But evidently, a lot of people do not trust the media. It's at historic lows, according to this poll.
It's fake news.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it probably is just the fact that, you know, you have a president out there talking about fake news. I mean, that has some impact. I mean, and when he does a rally and you have 6,000 people there who are you know, full-throatedly agreeing with him that the media is the problem, you know, yeah, it has an impact. You know, I'm sort of glad that it's a third of the people.
I mean, there's both sides have placed the media at the center of the narrative on why things are going wrong. The Trump supporters, conservatives, argue that we're liberal and that, you know, that's the problem. We're not telling the truth about his achievements, and we're not we're obstructing his efforts to do the right thing. On the other side, you know, the left says that we, you know, Trump won in no small part because of all the free media attention we gave him. Hillary Clinton, you know, Bernie supporters say that we created a narrative that made Hillary Clinton inevitable, that made it harder for Bernie Sanders to get traction and, you know, ride his momentum to a victory that they are convinced would have then, you know, Bernie Sanders would have beat Donald Trump. So on both sides of the spectrum, we're sort of the whipping boy for what's happened. And so it's not surprising to me that there's that 32%, because, you know, those are the folks that aren't maybe buying into either of those narratives. But we do have something. We have, you know, we always have, you know, work to do on trust in the media. I mean, after every election, and this one especially, people look back and say, you know, the media dropped the ball. It should have gone better. And that's what we're in. You know, that's what we're in now.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Pints and Politics, before a live audience in a beautiful setting next to the Mill Stream in the middle or the edge of Amana. We're here with Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, James Lynch of the Gazette, and my co-host, Aaron Jordan. We'll be back in just a minute. We're going to talk some state issues, Aaron, I think. We're going to talk about the first month with our new governor, Kim Reynolds, and ask if she's establishing her brand separate from the previous governor. Also, the fireworks law. We want to talk about that, I think. Todd had a column about that just today. Before we go to break, a quick poll. How many in our audience of, let's say, would you say 60 or 70? Is that fair? 60 or 70, clap. You have two choices. You like it, you don't like it. On or off, right? Okay. How many of you like Iowa's new fireworks law? Clap. Okay, how many of you dislike it? We'll be back in just a moment. It's a special edition of River to River, live from Amana. We're back with more of this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer in Amana. We're alongside the Mill Stream with the Gazette, partnering with the Gazette once again for an edition of Pints and Politics at Mill Stream Brewing Company in Amana before a live audience. Let's hear it, live audience. What a beautiful evening we have out here in late June. We had expected storms, and it cleared so that we could have a stormy political discussion. Aaron Jordan, my co-host, groans and moans. Yes, I deserve him. Along with us on our panel here, we have Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch of the Gazette. And we're resuming now our political discussion. We want to pivot our focus to from the national scene, which we did last half hour, to talk more about state politics. Aaron, what do we want to talk about?
That's right. So Iowa has a new governor, Governor Kim Reynolds, and Iowa's first female governor. So, you know, she's had an eventful few weeks here, been traveling around state tour. She presented to President Trump. You know, one of the questions from the audience is, you know, what prominence is Governor Reynolds going to have on the national scene, given Iowa's place as the first caucus state? Let you guys tee off on that one.
Well, she, in an article in Politico today, she was talking about how people who might be thinking about running for president in the future are quickly becoming her best friends. She's getting lots of phone calls. You know, so, I mean, we don't even think about, you know, 2020, but other people are, I guess. And she said, yeah, she's hearing from all of them. So I think, you know, being governor of Iowa sort of guarantees you prominence on the political front. And the challenge for her as any Iowa governor is how do you use that to your advantage? And I think Kim Reynolds is in sort of a, well, let's say interesting, perhaps precarious position. She is sort of the governor of Trump America. This is a state that went for Barack Obama twice and then flipped and went for Donald Trump. These are Trump people. This is a Trump state in that sense. And she's the governor. She was at the White House yesterday meeting with Trump. She and I think three other governors were at this round table on health care or on energy. So she's getting some attention. Trump mentioned her at the rally that she's going to be a fantastic governor, which might have sounded like an endorsement, especially if you're Ron Corbett. But yeah, I mean, she's going to be on the front lines.
She's only been in office now since Terry Branstad has become U.S. ambassador to China. Has she had time to establish a brand? Is there a brand, a Kim Reynolds brand, emerging from behind the governorship of Terry Branstad that you can see?
I don't see one yet. Not yet. I think there's an opportunity for her to establish herself. I don't think Terry Branstad was necessarily a strong governor in the recent past. So I think there's an opportunity there for her to kind of make that position her own. I also think that I hope she takes the neutrality that's generally been a part of the governorship in Iowa because of the caucuses and carries that forward where Iowa kind of continues on the route that it needs to continue without that national influence. I think that will be a big test for her in the coming year and kind of making this her own and making this state its own state.
So, James, you had mentioned Ron Corbett, Cedar Rapids mayor, as being saying he's running for governor as a Republican. So let's talk about the host of people who are planning to run for governor as Democrats. I mean, the size of the pool, you know, we just had Ross Wilburn. You wrote an article about former Iowa City Mayor Ross Wilburn throwing his hat in the ring. Do you think the size of this Democratic pool is normal, is what you might expect?
Well, when you're the party out of power, I guess it's not surprising that a lot of people want to jump in and think they know they're the right person to lead the party and to lead the party back into the governor's office. You know, a month or two ago, we were talking about how there was no Democratic bench. You know, who are they going to put up for governor? Well, now they've got a baseball team of candidates, you know, running, and one's already dropped out. So, you know, there's no lack of candidates. You know, a year from now, when there's a primary, I don't know that we'll have nine candidates. We might have half that many, or, you know, there might be a few less. There's some talk in Democratic circles that some of these people should drop out of the governor's race and run for Congress. I don't know if that'll happen or not. I guess it worked for David Young when he dropped out of the Senate race. Right. And decided to run for Congress. But I think two things. One, I think it shows that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the Democratic Party to come back and to sort of pull things back the other way from the Republican control we've seen, especially this year. And I think it also probably shows, is indicative of some division within the party as people are sort of jockeying for a control, whether progressives versus moderates versus, I don't know if there is such a thing as a conservative Democrat anymore. But
what do you think that the Democrats can leverage most effectively as issues in Iowa?
Right now, it's probably the budget, but I think healthcare is going to be a big issue. You know, regardless of what Congress does, I think healthcare is going to be a big issue. The state budget condition is going to be right now, everybody's sort of teeing off on that. Of course, it's always hard to know what's going to be an issue 6 months from now or a year from now. You know,
Todd, you look like you have something to say.
Well, no, I was just looking at the mill stream, and it occurred to me that maybe water quality might be something that Democrats might want to talk about. I don't know if this is an impaired waterway, but, it, you know, a lot of them are. So, and Republicans haven't so far been able to kind of settle on where they want to go on that issue. Kim Reynolds has sort of talked about letting the legislature do its thing on that, hasn't had a plan of her own. Her primary opponent has a plan. Democrats will probably be coming out with some sort of plans of their own. So I think that'll be an interesting issue. Tax reform also is going to be significant. I don't know with the budget situation next year that they're going to be able to do significant tax reforms. You need some money and some space in the budget to do that, which they apparently don't have. So, you know, it's going to be fought along those lines. But as we know in politics now, it'll be also be a lot of outside groups coming in to hunt legislators' records and Kim Reynolds' record for votes and various issues to distort and in, you know, multi-million dollar TV campaigns. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's always a big factor.
It's always interesting to me in doing shows about water quality, now that you mentioned it, Todd, that a lot of Iowans are not aware that we are in a state that has some of the lowest water quality in the entire U.S. We're ranked right near the bottom. And to test, to wonder, does that bother us? It's a political discussion. Is something going to happen there? I don't know.
Well, apparently it doesn't bother us enough to do something about it.
And we've promised, you know, we've made promises that we're going to do our part to help reduce the size of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is basically taking money out of the pockets of people who fish in the Gulf of Mexico, fishermen, tourist industries down there, tens of millions of dollars. And it's because we in the Midwest allow the runoff to carry nitrates and phosphorus and other chemicals into the Gulf and create the hypoxia zone. So we've made promises. Right now we have a voluntary effort to do it. That seems to be the political consensus, regardless of how you may feel about that. But how much money are you going to put into taking steps to see that voluntary program, those goals get met? And right now we're just not putting the investments into it. We voted to create a trust fund in 2010. There hasn't been any political will to raise the sales tax to fill it. I think with the budget situation and what we're seeing with all of the tax credits that have been given away and all the things that are causing the budget to be out of balance, looking for that new revenue in the form of a sales tax increase may end up being eventually what's done, but there doesn't seem to be the political will for it at this point.
So, you know, we talked in the first half just about health care, and one of our audience members notes that there have been cutbacks on both the state and federal levels. This audience member wants to know what you think this means for mental health services in Iowa.
Well, it's not good news. You know, and the budget situation means that it's going to be hard to find the resources to sort of replace what's been taken away in terms of mental health services. I think we're going to hear a whole lot of talk about in mental health and in other services about finding efficiencies, but the efficiencies probably aren't going to free up enough resources to do what the advocates really want to see done. You know, the budget situation has to be solved before there are going to be resources to do those sorts of things. And right now, I'm not sure, you know, anybody has a solution. Nobody wants to raise taxes. Short of that, I'm not sure what you do to find the resources.
You know, I was hopeful when we started to see this change in mental health care that we would finally get to the point where mental health care would just become health care. But we haven't really gotten to that point yet. But we do still have this transition from institutionalized mental health services to the community-based. So when you look at that in combination with our funding, then what you're going to end up with is a system that's very much geography-based. And it's going to depend on where you live, whether or not you're going to get the services that you need, or whether or not you're going to be able to get your kids the services that they need. So I don't know here in Iowa. I think we're doing better because of the split into the different regions. But we do need parity between those regions, and we need parity within the counties that are a part of the regions. And, you know, it's going to take a little bit more tweaking, which I think the legislature could actually do and do fairly easily. But that's going to be difficult when they're still fighting over the modernization or privatization of Medicaid.
If you've just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Key. For Pints and Politics, before a live audience at Millstream, outside of the Millstream Brewing Company in Amana, alongside, as we heard mentioned, the Millstream, my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette, along with our panelists Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch. Well, one of the big things we've been hearing about, passed by the 2017 legislature here in Iowa, is the new fireworks law. What's the reaction from our panelists to that?
Just to add to that, you know, some cities are not allowing the use of fireworks in town. So I live in Iowa City and I'm not hearing much of this, but then I read the Gazette's opinion page and I think every single letter to the editor today was about the fireworks. So this is a big issue in cities where they are allowing the use.
Well, I mean, what we're hearing in Cedar Rapids especially is that folks are taking advantage of this, you know, law to excess. I mean, they're shooting off fireworks every hour of the night, and of course, day and night. And of course, this, you know, happening in a more densely populated urban area like a city like Cedar Rapids is going to cause lots of problems. People are upset. We're getting a lot of letters. I'm hearing from people who were in favor of the law, who are upset that, you know, their neighbors have decided that they, you know, are going to fire off fireworks all the time, every day. They're going to go to the tents and reload and come back and fire off more fireworks. So personally, I still think that there should be some room in the law for the sale and use. But I think what we're seeing, especially in cities, is that we may have to have a different conversation about how much that's limited and what sort of limits are going to be placed on that. I mean, in the countryside and smaller towns, I don't know that this is a problem. But in a place like Cedar Rapids, obviously, this is not working, and it's upsetting people.
Well, and I think James can speak to this more, but in the past, and fireworks has been a part of the discussion in Des Moines for several years. I mean, they've been hemming and hawing, going back and forth on it. But every one of those previous bills, as far as I know, had a year buffer, I guess. So it would be passed, signed into law 1 year, and wouldn't actually go into effect the next year. So what the legislature did to all of our communities is force them within the span of about a month to set rules regarding these new legalized fireworks. And that's not fair to the communities. They didn't have time to talk with residents. They didn't have time to plan enforcement. I think a lot of communities didn't really know what the law was, because now we have two out-of-state fireworks companies suing for Central Iowa communities. So, you know, part of this rests on the legislature. Even if you like the fireworks bill, even if you were in favor for legalized fireworks, it could have been done in a more thoughtful and constructive manner, I think.
If you just joined us. If you just joined us, a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, alongside the Millstream in Amana, Iowa, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch of the Gazette, along with my co-host, Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio. Aaron, you've got a whole stack of questions. We've got a very little bit of time, but let's get to some more questions, huh?
That's right. So someone from our audience here asked, you know, we have a law on the books now that allows medical marijuana to some degree, but, you know, I think I heard on IPR this week just that, you know, there may be very few people taking advantage of that because of some of the rules in place. You know, what do you guys think about the chances of this really catching on here?
Well, I think we'll see more expansion over time, but you know, we're very cautious here in Iowa. We don't want to rush to the forefront of making medical marijuana available. And there's a lot of practical sort of hurdles that have to be crossed. This idea that we were going to sort of work with Minnesota and their program isn't all that successful either. So there's a challenge there. But I think people are sort of coming around to the fact that there are benefits that for people with epilepsy, with people with various conditions. And I think, you know, every year, I expect there'll be a medical marijuana debate again next year in the legislature and the year after that. And eventually we'll get to some point where it's actually available in a way that people can take advantage of the law.
Okay.
Well, and that's sort of the sad aspect of the debate is that people right now could use the help. And eventually it will happen. We will have a medical marijuana program. It's too bad that we have to sort of go through the political hoops at this point. The wild card, I guess, is that you've got the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is talking about maybe using the Justice Department's powers to start prosecuting medical marijuana outlets across the country. The Obama administration sort of pulled back from that and gave states room to maneuver, but that may change under the Trump administration. So it wouldn't surprise me to see that used as an excuse at the State House in Des Moines to not take any action because the federal picture looks cloudy. That's been the part of the excuse in recent years.
All right, I have another question. You know, we had talked a little bit earlier just about, I think James had mentioned income tax, or maybe it was Todd had mentioned that Governor Reynolds has said she wants to reform income taxes. You know, there was some question this year, and I think the Register, the Des Moines Register, had a great story talking about whether the state had enough revenue to actually pay people's income tax refunds. There was not enough money in the checkbook, as it were, at the time when these, you know, returns were coming in. So what do you think, you know, do you think that's going to be a tough sell in terms of, you know, reforming or changing the income tax structure when we're looking at not having enough revenue in the state?
Well, income tax reform means different things to different people. You know, there was an effort underway this year in the legislature started, but I don't think anybody expected to finish it, looking at tax credits. You know, the state has like $450 million a year in potential tax liability for tax credits. There's talk about, you know, flattening the income tax system and having maybe like three brackets rather than and getting rid of federal deductibility and things like that. So tax reform means different things to different people. And that's part of the problem when you try to talk about tax reform is that you're not necessarily talking about the same thing as the person next to you. But I think, as Todd said, it's going to be very tough to do tax reform when you don't have any money in the checkbook. It's much easier to do it when you've got a nice cushion in the bank, and if, you know, tax reform results in lower revenue, you can sort of float through that. But it's going to be very tough next year to reduce any taxes and still pay the bills.
Well, you know, obviously Republicans ran on cutting taxes or reforming taxes. I mean, the trouble is legislators of both parties over the last, I don't know, two decades have basically given that tax cut away to someone else already. They've carved out loopholes. They've given sales tax exemptions to all sorts of interests. They've done the business tax credits that you were just talking about. And, you know, in isolation, each one of those looks perfectly doable and politically beneficial. But then you add them all up and they add up to billions and billions and billions of dollars every year. And now the last one they did, well, in 2013, they did a commercial property tax reform effort where they've agreed to backfill money to local governments and they've funded a credit for sort of the smaller scale businesses to get a tax break. And now that's costing, if you take the cost of the backfill and the extra school aid and everything, that's $300 million a year. And that's eating almost all of their available new revenue when revenues are sort of sluggish as they are now. So they've got this situation where they just don't have enough money. They have to do a 1.1% school funding increase. They have to cut the universities. They have to do tuition increases. And so you've got a situation where already your tax collections are not keeping up with your big sort of basic governmental needs. And if you try to do tax reform on top of that, that for Republicans in an election year probably has to mean reducing somebody's taxes. There's just no way to do it unless you go to that, you know, or you cut spending, which is painful in a lot of ways because, you know, with education and things, that there were, you know, spending cuts during the last recession that have never really been fully, you know, refilled. So you can cut that, or you go and look at that giant pile of loopholes and exemptions and tax breaks. That's difficult because then you have to look at interest groups that you once told, yeah, we'll help you out, and now you have to say, well, we're going to take away your favor. So there's no good way out of it unless you know, do maybe what Ron Corbett advocates, and that's raising one tax, using part of the proceeds of that to cut another tax. That's always not popular with everyone either.
And you also have this political climate. When you talk about those property taxes from 2013, that backfill is going to end. So I think the reason you're seeing so many school bond elections coming up now is because next year you're going to have all the cities with their hands out because that backfill is going to end for them. And so if you have then the state piling on top of that, you're going to have a lot of people kind of feeling the pain of things that have kind of been, to a certain extent, brushed under the carpet now for about 5 years.
And that ends a discussion recorded outside last night, outside Millstream Brewing Company in Amana. Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Joining me, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, James Lynch, and Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Emily Woodbury produced and edited this hour. Our sound engineer was Jim Davies. Our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.